Chapter 4, Sacred Mushrooms of Mexico. Summer, 1960, Cuernavaca. In the year 1960, Cuernavaca was a very charming place. For centuries, it had been a retreat for sophisticated Aztecs and corrupt politicians and wandering scholars like myself. One of my big heroes, Charles Lindbergh, the Lone Eagle himself, had courted Anne Morrow there. Back in the days of Moctezuma, this town, called Horn of the Cow, was a center of soothsayers and wise men and wizards and magicians. It seems that Cuernavaca lies just south in a line of volcanic peaks. There's Popo, Iztaccíhuatl, and Toluca. And on the slopes of these volcanoes grow the sacred mushrooms of Mexico, divinatory fungi, Teonanacatl, the very flesh of the gods. So my son Jack and I, well, we scouted the town and looked over the neighborhood, and we leased a villa out next to the golf course on the Acapulco Road. The house was a rambling white stucco deal with scarlet trim, surrounded by a gray stone wall. A frequent visitor to our villa was Gerhard Braun, an anthropologist, historian, linguist from the University of Mexico. Gerhard had been studying the culture of the Aztecs and translating texts written in Nahuatl, their ancient language. He had discovered frequent references in Nahuatl to the use of certain magic mushrooms. These mushrooms apparently were used by soothsayers to forecast the future. And as recreational devices, they were passed around to everyone on the ceremonial occasion, for example, of Moctezuma's coronation. Gerhard's curiosity was aroused. He asked me, as a psychologist, if I would like to try them. Then I remembered Frank Barron's joking prediction that the mushrooms, the sacred mushrooms of Mexico, might be the tool for changing the mind that we had been looking for. Okay, I said, why don't you see if you can find some? The following week, Gerhard phoned from Mexico City. He had met a curandera in the village of San Pedro, near the volcano of Toluca. Away from the tumult of the market, in the shade of a church wall, this witch Juana had showed him a bag of mushrooms. And when he obviously asked if they're safe, she popped two into her mouth. He took them home, washed them in cold water, and they were now resting on the center shelf of his refrigerator. See you Saturday, I said. Gerhard arrived around noon. With him came his girlfriend Joan, her daughter Amanda, and Betty, an English major from Berkeley, who wrote poetry and cracked jokes and played football with the boys. Gerhard had been talking with University of Mexico botanists and historians. While he sorted out the mushrooms, he told us some of the things he had learned. They were used by the Aztecs. They had been banned by the Catholic Church so effectively that leading contemporary botanists denied that such a species even existed. They had been pushed out of history's notice until the last decade, when they were rediscovered by botanists named Weitlinger and Schultes, and by two amateur mycologists, Valentina and Gordon Wasson. By this time, a few scientists, poets, and intellectuals looking for mystical experiences had tried the mushrooms. They were supposed to produce wondrous trances. Gerhard arranged the mushrooms in two bowls on a table under a huge beach umbrella. He said that we should each take six. The effect would begin in about an hour. Then he stuffed a big, black, moldy mushroom in his mouth, made a terrible face, and chewed. I watched his Adam's apple bounce as it went down. I picked one up. It stank of dampness. The smell was like the crumbling logs of certain New England basements, and it tasted worse than it looked. Bitter, stringy. I took a Carta Blanca beer and jammed the rest in my mouth and washed it down. Every one of us was listening to her or his own stomach, half expecting to be poisoned. Five of us sat on the sunlit terrace in our bathing suits, waiting, asking each other, how many did you take? Do you feel anything? Two people abstained. One was Ruth Dettering, who was pregnant. She had a degree in nursing, so I was very glad that she'd be there as an observer. The other abstainer was Bruce, the mathematician from Michigan who said he suffered from nervous fits and he feared a reaction. Bruce was wearing bathing trunks over flowered undershorts, green garters, black socks, leather shoes, and a silken robe, all of which were to become quite important in my visions. We appointed Bruce the official scientist. He was to take detailed notes of our reactions. Then I began to feel strange. It was like going under dental gas, mildly nauseous, detached, moving away, away, away from the group in bathing suits and a terrace under the bright Mexican sky. Everything was quivering with life, even inanimate objects. Dettering said he felt it too. Our scientist Bruce busied himself writing, his thin shoulders bent over the notepad like a Viennese psychoanalyst. The scientist. But Bruce had no idea what he was observing. This professional revelation struck me as immensely comic. Laughing, 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 I couldn't stop laughing. Everyone looked at me in astonishment. Their wonder increased my amusement. Then Bruce looked up, his red tongue flicking out from the shrubbery of his beard. And so I laughed again at my own everyday pomposity, the narrow arrogance of scholars, the impudence of our rational minds, and the smug naivety of words we used, in contrast to the rich, raw, ever-changing panoramas that flooded my brain. I walked into the house and fell on the bed. Dettering followed, watching. Dick, did you see it? Our little minds? Dick nodded. Good. He saw it. He began to laugh. So I gave way to the delight, as mystics have for centuries when they peeked through the curtains and discovered that this world, so manifestly real, was actually a tiny stage set constructed by our little minds. Hey, there was a sea of possibilities out there, and in there, other realities, an infinite array of programs for other possible futures. Starting back to the terrace, hello, my walk has now changed to a rubber leg slither. The room was apparently filled with invisible liquid. I undulated over to Poet Betty. Her beautiful classic face unfolded like a sunflower. She was in some place of bliss. And there was Ruth Dettering, standing good nurse by the door. I swam over to her. Look, Ruth, I said, sounding surprisingly normal. God, seems that these mushrooms are stronger than I expected. I think you should send the kids to the movies in town, and you better give the maid the afternoon off and kind of stay close and keep your eyes on things. Then I was gone. Gone into the fabled optical department. Nile palaces, Hindu temples, Babylonian boudoirs, Bedouin pleasure domes, gem flashery, woven silk gowns breathing color, mosaics flaming with Mutsi emeralds and Burma rubies and Ceylon sapphires. And here, look, here come those jewel serpents, those familiar Moorish reptiles sliding, coiling, tumbling down the drain in the middle of my retina. Next came a trip through evolution, guaranteed to everyone who signs up for this brain tour. Slipping down the recapitulation tube to those ancient midbrain projection rooms, you know, snake time, fish time, down through giant jungle palm time with greasy, lacy fern leaf time. I calmly observed the first sea thing crawl to shore. I lay with her, sand rasping under my cheek, and then I floated down, down to the deep green ocean. Hello, I'm the first living thing. Attention, it is now 8 o'clock, stop. Mushroom eating began at 5 o'clock, stop. Effects starting to wear off, stop. I want to stay here, stop. I'm returning, stop, stop, stop. Having moments of non-trance consciousness, stop. Then enrapturing visions return, don't stop. Don't stop. Don't stop. Well, the journey lasted a little over 4 hours, and like everyone else, once the veil is drawn, I came back a changed man. You've heard the stories from St. John of the Cross, from Aldous Huxley, from your kid brother, from William Blake, from John Lennon, from Plato after Ulysses. You've heard Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and on and on and on. Everyone agrees that there are these extraordinary realms within the brain waiting for us to explore. And we've all listened to and we've read our share of breathless reports from trippers. And yet, for most people, this discovery, the first time, is a glorious surprise. Mystics come back raving about higher levels of perception, where one sees realities 100 times more beautiful and meaningful than the reassuring, familiar scripts of normal life. For most people, it's a life-changing shock to learn that their everyday reality circus is just one of hundreds of circuits which, when turned on, are equally real, pulsing with strange forms and mysterious biological signals. Accelerated and amplified, many of these alternative realities can be microscopic in exquisite detail, and others, telescopic. Since psychedelic drugs expose us to different levels of perception and experience, use of them ultimately is a philosophic enterprise, compelling us to confront the nature of reality and the nature of our fragile subjective belief systems. It's this contrast that triggers the laughter and the terror. We discover, abruptly, with a shock, that we've been programmed all these years and that everything we accept as reality is just social fabrication. In the 29 years since eating mushrooms in a garden in Mexico, I've devoted most of my time and most of my energy to the exploration and classification and application of these new circuits of the brain and figuring out their implications for evolution, past and future. In 4 hours by the swimming pool in Cuernavaca, I learned more about the mind, the brain, and the inner structures than I did in the preceding 15 years as a diligent, hardworking psychologist. What did I learn? I learned that the brain is an underutilized biocomputer containing billions of unaccessed neurons. I learned that normal consciousness is one drop in an ocean of intelligence, and that consciousness and intelligence can be systematically expanded and charted, that the brain can be reprogrammed, that the knowledge of how the brain operates is the most pressing scientific issue of our time. Hey, I was beside myself with enthusiasm, convinced that, hey, perhaps we had found the key we had been looking for. The days after my first trip were free for introspection and contemplation, and this was very lucky. A heavy, mind-opening experience is upheaval time for anyone. In subsequent manuals and lectures and books, I have always suggested that at least one day be freed from mundane distraction after the experience so that one can quietly digest what's happened. A few days later, I drove to the nearby village of Tepoztlan, that mystical, wonderful village, to share these incredible discoveries with my boss, Professor McClellan. In addition to being a gallantly creative psychologist, McClellan had become a Quaker. This intrigued me. The Quaker religion was a transcendental religion founded on the wild, visionary experiences of this guy, George Fox. So I naturally expected that Professor McClellan would be very receptive to the idea of trying mushrooms in our research. Well, he wasn't. Moreover, he seemed vaguely annoyed by my enthusiastic predictions about the value of the open mind and altered states for psychological research. You see, McClellan cared for me, and he did believe in my existential transactional theories for behavior change. And he did cherish the hope that he and I would work together to basically humanize psychology. So I sketched out a proposal for systematic drug experiments at Harvard. And as my faculty sponsor, McClellan became understandably alarmed at the administrative and political problems he could foresee down the line. During that meeting with McClellan, I realized that it was practically impossible to convey the experience of the open mind and altered states to someone who hadn't been there. I remembered my own negative reaction to Baron when he tried to relate his mushroom experiences to me. Even the most supporting friend, you know, looked at you with skepticism. So, you saw bizarre things. So, you made yourself crazy for 6 hours. So what does this have to do with the practical problems of normal life? I tried to explain to McClellan. The activity of every sense organ is intensified. Colors and shapes are fresh and clear. Consciousness is accelerated. I became every musical instrument I could hear or ever had heard. Everything was alive. Even inanimate objects sent signals, took on meanings. Bruce's beard took on meaning? I don't get it, sighed McClellan. And then he glanced at his watch. Frank Baron, my pal, arrived, and Frank was delighted to learn that I'd taken the mushrooms. We spent long hours by the pool drinking another powerful native potion, namely tequila and tonic, having long discussions about the scientific implications of this open-mind, multiple reality phenomena. When I told Baron about McClellan's resistance, he sternly warned me about the compulsive tendency of everyone who'd had this experience to run around explaining it to everyone and telling everyone about the amazing events and what they mean. Cool it, said Frank. Soon, we would all find out that the world is apparently divided into those who have had the experience or were eager to have it and those who had not and shuddered at the possibility. Well, Frank and I agreed down there in Mexico to start a research project at Harvard to pursue this further. Frank would concentrate on the creativity aspects while I would work on using the drugs to accelerate behavior change.